now proceed to the next case on the docket. Counsel, you have 15 minutes. You care to resume any time for
Thank you, ma'am. Judge Decker, probably about 5 minutes. I doubt I won't be. I don't think I'll need it all, but it won't be as swift as the prior counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Moss.
Yes, ma'am. Police court. My name is Jack Moss, and represent Mr. Al-Hayani, who was convicted on a conditional guilty plea of felony cigarette trafficking. The issue in this case, of course, is whether or not, under the totality of the circumstances, he had there was an objection to the search of his vehicle that discovered 794 cartons of cigarettes. Now, we all understand that, you know, when an officer is looking at doing a search after the conclusion of the traffic stop, that there has to be some kind of probable cause to give him reasonably criminal behavior is ongoing. The trial court in this case made five factual findings to which certainly this court has to defer. Number one, it said that Mr. Al-Hayani was nervous, gave conflicting answers about where he was going. That number two, he's coming from the direction of Richmond. Number three, he was headed to New York. Number four, he was in a rented van. And number five, Judge Sander found that the van was filled with non-transparent black bags inside of which were square shapes consistent with boxes or cartons. Those are the factual findings that really this court has to rely upon. So, you know, when you deal with a case where, you know, you have the totality of circumstances, they're all very fact-dependent, and you're not going to find really what you need in published decisions. These are the kind of things, you know what the general rule is, and you look to unpublished decisions. A fairly good unpublished decision recently from the Fourth Circuit was United States versus Bryant, B-R-Y-A-N-T, docket number 15-4618. It was decided July 19th of this year. That was a case in which the court was dealing with a motion to suppress relating to a felony firearm possession charge. Judge Diaz writing from the majority of the
Counsel,
court.
This case is not in your brief, is it?
It is not in the brief, no ma'am.
Okay.
It was something that I discovered afterwards. The brief, I think, the original brief was written in June. This case was decided after that.
But you didn't file a reply brief?
I did file a reply brief, but it was only to the Commonwealth's argument about the second issue, which is standing challenge search. But the court there dealt with the fact of nervousness when you are confronted with a police officer. And the court said that only those among us with ice water in our veins would fail to exhibit signs of nervousness when confronted by a police officer. So as far as the first finding of the trial court, well, Mr. Al-Hayani was nervous. That's to be expected.
But we have Virginia cases that say that that's entitled to be considered, correct?
It is, but the question is whether or not that, with the other things the trial court found, are sufficient to give the officer probable cause.
But you wouldn't dispute that nervousness is a factor that under Virginia law is entitled to be considered?
It's entitled to some consideration, yes, ma'am. Second finding of the trial court was he was traveling from the direction of Richmond. This stop was in Louisa County. According to the record, he was heading towards Harrisonburg to go up 81 to New York. Okay, there were a lot of places in between Richmond and Louisa he could have been coming from. Just because he came from the direction of Richmond and the fact that he'd been convicted in Richmond 2 years earlier of misdemeanor cigarette trafficking is really not a significant factor that the officer could have relied upon. The third thing, he's headed to New York. I mean, my gosh, how many people are headed to New York along the interstate? The trooper said people do it all the time. And they take that route from Richmond, say, going up 95, go 64 west.
Didn't the trooper also testify in his testimony that in his training, and granted it was one training session, but he was under the tutelage that people would go from Richmond or Virginia area up north. So couldn't that be a factor that could be considered in terms of cost to search the car? Isn't that a valid thing for them to consider.
Well, again, Judge, when you deal with the totality of circumstances, sure, everything that he knew, everything that he recognized is something for him to consider. The question is whether or not all of those things taken together rise to the level of probable cause. I mean, Trooper Chris said when he first approached the vehicle, and he saw the tags, saw the New York tags on it, and when he first approached the vehicle, he had his flashlight. This was at night, and he could see inside the back of the van that it was full of black plastic trash bags. He went ahead and conducted the traffic stop, you know, of course, questioning the driver in the process, went back to his vehicle, wrote the summons, gave it to the summons, and gave it to the driver, and then asked for consent to search, which was denied. Nothing had changed between the time he initially approached the driver, saw that stuff in the car, in the van, and then the time he came back later and said, "I'd like to search the car," and the driver said no.
But he saw more than just black bags in the car, didn't he? He said that the shape within them appeared to be consistent with unpackaged cigarette boxes.
Well, what he said he saw was square box shapes. I mean, all the boxes I know of Judge Atlee are square.
No, I've seen a lot of rectangles out there.
Or rectangles, but they have corners to them. I mean, certainly if you have posters, I guess you roll up in mail, it can be in a circular mailer, but most boxes are square or rectangular. There's nothing about those boxes that made them distinctive as cigarette.
Wasn't there also
boxes.
Independent appeared to be packs of cigarettes on top of the boxes?
There were no packs, Judge. There were boxes of cartons, and then there were a couple of bags on top with individual cartons or loose cartons, or they didn't meet the they weren't enough fit, I guess, in a box. But there was nothing that was visibly identifiable as being a cigarette carton.
But his testimony was that the small boxes on top of the big boxes appeared to be the same shape, consistent with cartons of cigarettes, correct?
I don't think that he was able to say that the small boxes, there were loose cartons, because all he could see was the bags were tied up. I don't think he said that it was consistent with the really elongated shape of cigarette cartons. So, I mean, basically, those are the factors that the court gave. Those are the ones that I think this court is stuck with. Trooper Chris, again, Judge, he said, "I had one training course, no prior experience on this. I've never had one of these cases before." And in his own words, he said on page 56 of the appendix, "I had an idea." All he had was a hunch or an idea. He didn't have probable cause to search the vehicle without consent. And as this court well knows, a hunch is kind of the least levels of cause you can have. The hunch, reasonable suspicion, probable cause. All he had was a hunch that did not give him the right to search without a warrant, without my client's consent. Now, I need to address the other question, which was raised by the Commonwealth in its brief, which is standing in a contested search. We have laid out in our reply brief the reasons why we think the case is cited by the Commonwealth or an apposite. But one of the things the court also needs to remember is that this was a conditional guilty plea. Mr. Al-Hayani tendered a plea contingent upon his ability to challenge a search in this court. And if this court were to say he didn't have standing to do that, then in fact it's depriving him of the basis upon which he entered that conditional guilty plea. So for the reasons set forth in our briefs, our initial brief and our reply brief, we're asking this court to overturn the Louisiana Circuit Court, say the motion to suppress should have been granted, and then remanded for proceedings consistent with that opinion. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Moss, could you make sure you provide Mr. Katz a copy of the opinion you cited to
Yes, ma'am.
That you didn't have in the brief?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Mr. Katz.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Benjamin Katz appearing on behalf of the Commonwealth.
Before you get started, Mr. Katz,
Should you feel a need to respond to the U.S. v. Bryan case, you'll have 3 days to put something in writing.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And submit it to the court. Don't feel compelled, only if you need to.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could take up the standing issue first, I would point out that counsel failed to raise the conditional guilty plea and its aspects on the consideration of this issue on appeal in his reply brief. I would have liked the opportunity to respond to that as well. But I would argue his attempt to distinguish factually the cases upon which we rely, I would argue are a distinction without a difference. Clearly, there is a continuum along which the expectation of privacy may become unreasonable. And certainly some of the federal cases I have cited demonstrate extreme examples of an unreasonable expectation of privacy where the car is stolen or is in the midst of being repossessed. But nevertheless, in this specific case, the expectation of privacy is governed by the contract entered into with the rental company.
What authority do you have to indicate that the rental contract controls that expectation?
Well,
usually, as you've noted, it's cars where they don't have a possessory right because the car's been stolen or because somebody else has a greater civil right to it, such as a repossession.
Certainly. I would submit that the logical inference that would flow from the evidence demonstrating, A, he was constrained in the geographical area in which it could be used, and B, constrained in the time in which it could be used.
But that's a contractual term. It's not necessarily an element that takes away the possessory right of that particular person.
Well, I think my response would be that any argument that one could expect privacy in a car held under circumstances which violated the agreement would be less reasonable than if you were operating it under the agreement. And so the trial court could certainly consider that. I would argue as a matter of law it was not wrong. The burden was on the defendant to demonstrate that he had an expectation of privacy, and the court clearly found that the agreement, that the car was driven outside of the terms of the agreement. So I think in light of those facts, the legal conclusion that an expectation of privacy would be unreasonable is not an incorrect conclusion. I don't think it's necessary to prove that there was some other understanding. I think on the face of the agreement alone, you could reach that conclusion. And the argument that it hadn't been reported stolen, I would submit as apples and oranges. Whether the rental company believed he had an intent to permanently deprive them of the vehicle is immaterial. The expectation of privacy is only reasonable where the agreement is being operated, where the car is being operated in compliance with the agreement. But if the court rejects that argument, clearly there is additional facts in support of this search.
Counsel, before you move on, what's the impact of the conditional guilty plea on the standing?
Well, I think clearly the trial court can't constrain this court in terms of what it can and can't consider on appeal. If an issue is preserved, it is preserved, and if it is not preserved, it's not preserved. So I would have enjoyed an opportunity to address that and to consider it in greater detail than in the time allowed today. But to the extent it was not presented and the trial court didn't have an opportunity to consider whether standing was actually an issue, we don't have a record on that ground. But as I say, it was the defendant's burden to establish standing. And I suppose this court could take the position that it was conceded by the Commonwealth in agreeing to the conditional plea. I think the record would support the Commonwealth conceded to the conditional guilty plea.
That was what I was getting at. Does that create a problem for you on the standing?
I think that would be a reasonable construction of this issue. I think this court could certainly reasonably say, to the extent the Commonwealth conceded in the guilty plea, the conditions of the guilty plea, that it conferred standing. And I don't have a response other than that. With respect to the stop and the search, I would argue that counsel does an admirable job of identifying the circumstances in isolation and eliminating them in isolation. But again, the measure is the totality of those circumstances. And as this court has indicated, we had an officer who had specialized training in the detection and interdiction of cigarette smuggling. Judge Attlee, in response to your question at page 35 of the joint appendix, thank you, Alan. There is the observation that the
lines 2 through 7 and 35.
There is that, and lines 13 through 15, the small boxes appeared to the officer to be the shape consistent with cartons.
Yes, sir.
So we have an officer who has specialized training, who knows from this training that smugglers tend to hide the cartons and the boxes within other bags. He finds bags matching that description. There is an initial assertion that the gentleman is moving to Harrisonburg, and yet there are no household items in the car, which is then later changed to New York. There is the fact of the prior conviction of cigarette smuggling. And all of those circumstances add together to make reasonable the belief that it would be likely to find contraband in the car to an officer who had had the training of this particular officer. And I don't...
Is there any... Let me just ask you, and this is just on one of the sort of finer points. You mentioned the prior conviction. Is there any legal authority for considering the prior conviction as part of the factor?
I'm not aware of any authority, but certainly it is a circumstance to consider. I mean, it certainly adds more to... In the absence of a prior conviction, I think a person of reasonable prudence could say, well, not only does this seem to me, in light of my training, to be cigarette smuggling, but this particular individual has done that before. I mean, clearly a reasonable person thinking objectively could take that into account. And I don't know of any authority that would say he could or could not. But if the test is, what would a reasonably prudent person do under these circumstances, I think it would have to add something to the circumstantial weighing. So in light of those circumstances, I would argue that there was, in fact, probable cause, and the conclusion of the trial court otherwise was not wrong as a matter of law. I'd be happy to answer any additional questions the panel may have.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Judge Adley, I saw the strong arguments here. Okay. But I think... Judge, you've hit it around the head in terms of the rental contract. Now, the trial court, you know, when you look at page 73 of the appendix, where it says, these are the things I'm basing it on, he mentions a rental van. He doesn't say it was an overdue rental van. This is a civil contract matter. You know, anybody who's had a car that's been damaged in a repair, you know, in an automobile accident, you take it to the repair shop, they give you a rental agreement for, or just a loaner for a couple of days, and if it takes longer to fix the car than initially contemplated, they say, don't worry about it, just keep the car for another day or so. That's fine.
Let me interrupt you and ask you, because you have limited time.
Yes,
what
ma'am.
In the record references the terms and conditions of the guilty plea that would specify the Fourth Amendment claim? In other words, are there particulars related to the plea that outline the ability to challenge the Fourth Amendment?
Well, certainly, Judge, the trial court, when it accepted the plea, went through the colloquy, and he understood that it was the, and I'll have to look, see in the record here.
But it's a general challenge to the Fourth Amendment, right?
It was... He reserved the right to appeal the trial court's having denied his motion to suppress.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am. You know, so, and again, in the cases that the Commonwealth cited in its brief about the standing issue, you know, those were cases where somebody else had the superior right. In the case of the vehicle, the Bell case, where the vehicle had been repossessed by the lien holder, and then the defendant, his girlfriend took it and loaned it to the accused in that case. And clearly, the accused had no possessory right in that vehicle. The other case cited by Commonwealth had to do with someone who had permission to be in someone else's apartment, but had no right to invite other people there. He didn't have possessions there. Nobody else in this case, other than Mr. Al-Hayani, had a superior right to possession of that vehicle, the rental van. He was in it. You know, you have to also, I think, realize you have an individual Middle Eastern Yemeni descent in terms of how much nervousness is permissible. You know, he's in a state that's not his own. He's driving a vehicle, which obviously, you know, we find out later on had contraband cigarettes in it. But the end doesn't justify the means in this case. There's nothing in the... fact, even taken totality circumstances to give rise, you know, give suspicion up to level of probable cause, to give Trooper Chris the right to involuntarily search his vehicle. So once again, we're asking the court to reverse the trial court on the motion to suppress and remand it for further proceedings.
Thank you, counsel. Welcome down and read.
Counsel, before the next case.